Welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists come to share their most recent work. I'm Angie, and for this week's episode, I am excited to share my conversation with Dr. Laura Williams. Laura is an assistant professor at Stanford University, jointly appointed between Stanford Psychology, Wuhan Neuroscience Institute, and Stanford Data Science. Her work is focused on understanding the neural representations and operations that give rise to speech comprehension in the human brain. In this episode, we chat about her recent paper titled Large-Scale Single-Neuron Speech Sound Encoding Across the Depths of Human Cortex. She shares the insights we can derive from a recently developed technique called NeuroPixels, which is essentially a tiny, tiny needle that can be placed into the awake human brain and record from hundreds of neurons at the same time. She also shares her personal journey into this line of work. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today. I am very excited to have this opportunity to chat with you on your recent paper titled Large-Scale Single-Neuron Speech Sound Encoding Across the Depth of Human Cortex. So I have to admit, I am not a cognitive neuroscientist by training, and this is a really, really dense title for me, a dense paper as well. But I think before taking a deep dive of the paper itself, maybe I wonder if you can give us some background or context on at this current stage, what do we know about how our brain deals with speech sound?
Yeah, nice question. And thanks so much for having me on the podcast. So what we know about how humans process speech is that first, the signal is processed by a lot of things in our auditory periphery before it even reaches the brain. Inside our ear, for example, there's a little shell-like structure called the cochlea, which breaks down the sounds into different frequency bands. So there's actually little, tiny little hairs in there, in the cochlea that will be excited by sounds of different frequencies. So low pitch sounds will excite one certain portion of the cochlea, and higher pitch sounds will excite a different part of the cochlea in this kind of continuous frequency space. And so having broken the auditory signal down into these different frequency bands, this travels then through a few different structures and ultimately ends in primary auditory cortex. And in primary auditory cortex, the neurons in that area actually recapitulate the structure in the cochlea. So you'll have some neurons that fire a lot to low-pitch sounds, and other neurons will fire a lot to high-pitched sounds. And what everything that I just described is shared across many different species. This isn't a human-specific thing. If you were to look in monkeys, for instance, you would see a similar type of organization. And what's special about humans is essentially all of the auditory processing that happens above the primary auditory cortex. So kind of the next part of the brain in the anatomical hierarchy is superior temporal gyrus. And that's actually the brain area that we're targeting in this paper, because the superior temporal gyrus has been shown to process more speech features of the acoustic input. So this is where you'll find responses to certain speech sounds, like a response that distinguishes a P like parakeet versus a B like barricade. And it also has responses that track like the syllable structure and the fluctuations in loudness that are very characteristic of the fluctuations that you get in speech and not in other types of environmental sounds. And then above that, then you start going into the realm of language processing rather than speech processing per se. From there, there's recognition of morphemes, so kind of the elemental chunks of words. And those morphemes get combined to create words, and then words get combined to create phrases. Essentially, as the brain is processing larger and more abstract properties of language, it's hypothesized that more and more neurons are recruited in that process, spanning across a larger and larger portion of the brain.
Got it. Yeah, thank you so much for taking us through this journey that a sound needs to travel through in order for me to understand what you are saying. But I'm wondering if you can help us with all, like, I guess for me, it's been a while since I'm in the cognitive neuroscience classes. Could you help me visualize what is it like?
Yeah, we're targeting primarily the left hemisphere, although it's controversial. The left hemisphere has been more causally linked to language processing. And we're looking at, so the temporal lobe is one of these kind of big chunks, but the temporal lobe is a very large portion of the cortex, the lower part of the brain that kind of, I don't know, sits like underneath your ear, basically. And we're targeting the superior temporal gyrus, which, yeah, sits like under your ear.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's right next to the primary auditory cortex. If you just go a little bit further along and you hit the superior temporal gyrus. And the superior temporal gyrus gyri are these kind of long structures. So it would have it from the posterior part, so towards the back of your brain, along moving further and further forward.
I see. Yeah, thank you. I think that helps a lot for me to figure out, okay, I think that's this part of my head. Thank you. Let's go into this paper. So what did you do? From reading the abstract and looking at the photo, it looks like you placed some probes inside the brains of folks. Like, what happened?
Yeah, maybe I can give a brief kind of background. So
yeah.
For people interested in how language is processed in the brain, you need to study humans processing language, given that humans are the only species to have fully developed language. And so if you're working with humans, you are far more limited on the types of ways that you can record brain activity. So the vast majority of human neuroscience has been with non-invasive methods of recording activity. And we've learned a lot from these approaches, but they have their obvious limitations. Primarily that, one, you're recording from a large population of neurons at the time. So without the ability to say, okay, this one particular neuron is responding to this feature and this other neuron is responding to this other feature. They all get melded together in one neural measurement. And secondly, for the techniques that are better at the spatial resolution, you don't have the ability to actually record the neuron as it fires at its natural millisecond. So here we are translating a neural measurement, like a neural recording technique called the NeuroPixels probe, for use in humans. So it was first introduced in 2017 and has been really revolutionary for work in animal models, in primates, for example. And the reason it's been so revolutionary is because it gives you the ability to record hundreds of neurons at the same time across the cortical depth. Yeah. And so here we're able to record from single neurons rather than having this aggregate response over hundreds of thousands of neurons together. We can actually record from individual neurons, and we can do so at large scale being not just a handful, like a dozen neurons at a time, but actually hundreds of neurons at the same time. And that gives you the ability to see how the neurons are actually communicating with one another.
Right.
And then the final piece is that we're doing so at these different cortical depths. So the cortex is actually organized. It's like a three-dimensional structure. So you have, as I mentioned before, this brain area has, you go further towards the back of the brain or to the front of the brain or higher up in your head or lower down on your head. So that's a two-dimensional plane. You have the back, the front, the up, the down. But the neurons are not just organized in a two-dimensional space. They're actually organized in a three-dimensional space where the third dimension is this depth axis. So the gray matter of the neocortex is organized into six discrete layers where each layer is at a different depth relative to the surface of the brain. It's been shown in prior work that each of those six layers has a different role in the computations that are happening in that brain area. So here, by being able to record neurons from each of those six layers, we can understand what the computations are that the brain is applying when processing speech.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm so fascinated by this new tool, NeuroPixel Probe. Can you say more about how it is able to record from so many neurons at the same time? Because I have this vague memory that I think single neuron recording work is not something that's very recent, not as recent as 2017. It has been done in the past. So is the NeuroPixel Probe just developed to this specific goal, or does it also have some other clinical use and then the scientists decided to use that for a basic research purpose? And also, what does it look like? I'm so fascinated. Like, is that just a tiny needle that you put through your brain?
Yeah, okay. So first question was, so this, the ability to record single neurons, you rightly say, is not new. In animals, we've been doing it for a long time, but typically this has been on a much smaller scale, whereby you record from, let's say, a dozen neurons at the same time, whereas here you could record from hundreds of neurons at the same time. And the way that's made possible is through special fabrication of like nanotechnology, where the probe itself indeed does look like a very, 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 very thin needle, but it's as thin as like a human hair. Like, it's, I think the measurement is 70 microns wide, and it's 1 centimeter long, at least in this generation of probe. And along that 1 centimeter, it has just shy of 1,000 electrodes along that 1 centimeter length. And you can choose to record from 400 of them along the probe at the same time. These sensors that are packed along the 1 centimeter length, they're actually smaller than the neurons themselves that you're recording from. So when a neuron fires and that is picked up by the probe, the footprint of that activity is actually picked up from about 8 of these tiny little sensors. And yeah, if you have lots of neurons are tightly nestled in next to each other, it gives you the ability to resolve what neurons are firing at different locations along the probe. So the advance is really in this amazing nanotechnology that's been developed by this company called IMEC in Belgium. And right now, it doesn't have clinical use, but this may change in the future. It's still in its early development stages, and it's been used so far for basic science questions, but it definitely can holds the potential to be a really powerful clinical device. For example, you could imagine being able to better understand where epileptic activity is coming from, example. So rather at the kind of millimeter scale, you could track the evolution of epileptic seizures at the micron scale instead. And so this would give additional precision for the clinicians mm-hmm. who are trying to determine the location of epilepsy, for instance. But yeah, so we're not quite there yet, but it has amazing implications for basic science of being able to mm-hmm. basically have access to this third spatial dimension that I mentioned that just mm-hmm. wasn't really accessible before.
Right. Yeah, fascinating. I guess I'm just trying to visualize or imagine how you put the probe into the place that you want to place. Could you say more about that? Because one thing I was very shocked when I was reading it is like, well, I guess it also makes sense because these are all awake participants. Are they just have their skull open and you put it in? How did that happen? Does it hurt?
So the way this works, these are people who are undergoing, as you say, an awake brain surgery to treat a clinical condition. Mm-hmm. Either they're having a resection to treat epilepsy or to treat a tumor. And the reason that it needs to be awake is because before the resection of tissue happens, the surgeon will essentially map out where the critical areas for language are that mm-hmm. should not be resected so that the person doesn't end up with language difficulties after the operation. And so after the language mapping procedure, the surgeon inserts mm-hmm. the probe into tissue which is about to be resected as part of their clinical care. Mm-hmm. So the probe is very thin, very small, and makes like nominal tissue damage. This needs to be like further tested, but I think that the tissue damage is essentially null. But until we can establish that is indeed the case, we want to be just exert a lot of caution and only put mm-hmm. the probe into tissue that is going to be resected anyway.
I see.
And so, yeah, so the probe, we place it in tissue. And then in this case, we ask the patient to listen to about 10 minutes of spoken language while the probe was in place. It doesn't hurt at all. There are no pain receptors on your brain. So this is, yeah, completely pain-free. And we, yeah, insert the probe, they listen for 10 minutes, and then we remove the probe and leave, and then the person finishes their surgery. The people who have very graciously volunteered to take mm-hmm. part in this research for the good of science, we're not doing anything that isn't part of their clinical care other than this mm-hmm. 10 minutes of putting the probe in. So, all of like the craniotomy so the surgeon has access to the brain and everything else is necessary as part of their care. And then mm-hmm. we use that as an opportunity to record.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. There's just one part that I didn't quite get it, because you mentioned that you need to make sure the part that was cut off was not critical to their language ability. But then you are also putting the probes on that part to measure the speech ability. Could you say more about that? I think there's something that I missed there.
Yeah, no, it's actually a very good point. So there's a difference between cortical tissue that responds to speech and encodes mm-hmm. properties of speech versus tissue which is causally necessary for speech processing. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of redundancy in how the brain is structured. And so there is a lot of tissue that responds to speech, but if you remove it, the person doesn't experience any measurable deficit in speech or language processing. So that's this sweet spot, like middle ground mm-hmm. that we're targeting is the tissue which is, it responds robustly to speech, but it's not causally linked to speech because precisely of the point that you made that we're only recording mm-hmm. from tissue to be removed. And so you don't want to remove tissue that is going to lead to language deficits after its removal.
Got it. Yeah, thank you so much for clarifying that. And now after learning all about these like very impressive procedure, maybe we can move on to the results. What are some surprising findings that you have found through this recording opportunity that was not necessarily available, say, 5 or 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think one of the main themes of what we found is that when you can record from neurons in the same, let's call it a cortical column, so one mm-hmm. vertical slice, the neurons are not all responding to the same properties of speech. In other words, they're highly heterogeneous. So mm-hmm. you'll have some neurons that responding to certain speech sounds or like features of speech. We call them phonetic features that say it would be a feature that distinguishes an S from a P sound. So properties that tell you what the individual speech sounds actually are. There'll be neurons that fire very strongly for S sounds, for example. But so they're really like S's and F's that have this fricative component to them, but they don't fire in response to M's and P's that don't have that mm-hmm. fricative component. Yeah, so some neurons really like those types of properties. And then you can find just right next door a neuron that codes for the pitch of the speaker. So mm-hmm. is the person's just raised the pitch of their voice to emphasize something? Have they just done like a declination of the pitch of their voice? And yeah, that's a very different type of feature of speech than mm-hmm. the individual speech sounds. You can imagine actually articulating the same speech sounds, but with a different pitch, or mm-hmm. vice versa, using the same pitch of voice, but using different speech sounds. And so mm-hmm. those two neural populations can actually respond very differently from each other, depending on the actual input that they're hearing. And there are other properties of speech, too, that you can find in the same areas, like the loudness of someone's voice, for instance. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we found that in a given column, you'll have neurons that encode all of these different features rather than all of the neurons responding to the same thing. And the second thing is that with that heterogeneity, so with the variation in the types mm-hmm. of speech features being encoded, they weren't just like randomly distributed across the depth, but certain mm-hmm. features tended to localize to certain depths in the cortex. Mm-hmm. So one neuron and its neighbor, for instance, are more likely to encode the same thing than a neuron that is a few millimeters away. So you have a local structure.
I see.
And yeah, so we're excited to follow up with that to understand why they localize to certain depths and what this means for the actual circuit of responses in a cortical column.
Right. So I'm just trying to imagine. I don't know if this is the best analogy here, but it almost sounds like each columns of the cortex that you recorded on is almost like a shelf in grocery where grocery store where you're on different levels. You have things that are more similar together, but overall, the shelf has a whole bunch of different things. Is that kind of one way to think about it?
Yeah, that's a beautiful analogy. I might use that in the future. I'll cite you.
Thank you. I have a lot of questions. What you're just saying kind of reminds me of this idea that I learned in my undergrad cognitive neuroscience class on this called grandma cells theory, where I think there was this like idea that, it might be possible that in your brain, there's a very specific neuron responding to a very, very, very specific thing, like your grandmother. So is this idea related to what you have found? How is it different?
Yeah. So we don't find grandmother cells, and either in like specific terms or in nature of what it means to find a grandma cell. So like for us to find a grandma cell, what that means is that the neural code is extremely specific for a certain property of speech or language, let's say. And so the way that information gets encoded is you have very complex things encoded in one single neuron. But we actually find essentially the opposite coding scheme, where the alternative is that very complex things come about from listening to lots of neurons together. To follow the grandma analogy, you wouldn't have one neuron that encodes. No single neuron would encode that this is a grandma. But you can figure out that it's a grandma by listening to a large ensemble of, say, thousands of neurons together. That it's a distributed population code rather than a single neuron code. And we find that some information is like the grandma neuron that's encoded in one neuron. And that's true for things like the different properties of speech sounds, like the, as I mentioned, the fricative, for example, is encoded in one single neuron. But the more complex features of speech, you wouldn't be able to tell that, I know, the word being said is grandma, let's say, from listening just to one neuron. You would need to listen to a lot of neurons over a period of time in order to tell that's true. And maybe if we were to go to the next brain area along the kind of anatomical hierarchy, maybe the organization would be somewhat different. But at least in what we're seeing in this brain area, we don't see any super specific encoding of complex concepts.
I see. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much for explaining this. Because when I was reading this paper, I was like, is it super specific? Is it kind of like grandmother cell type of specific? But I think your answers totally helped me understand this better. And I'm also wondering whether you have any hypothesis about how the neurons kind of have this division of labors that they do. Do you have any hypothesis on how the organizations of these different functional properties of these neurons emerge?
Do you mean how does it come to be that certain neurons live on certain levels of the shelf? So I have some hypotheses, and it has to do with how information gets routed through this depth network. So it's hypothesized that, as I said, there are fixed shelves, let's say, and it's the layer 4 and 5 that receive inputs from the thalamus, direct inputs of what the acoustic input actually was. And it's layer 3, which has the ability to do more recurrent computation. So like maintaining information over time or accumulating information over time. And then at the surface layers, layer 1, 2, it's hypothesized to have more lateral connections. So this will be listening more so to what is going on in the neighboring column. Assumption in mind of where each of the layers are getting their inputs from, then you can hypothesize why it is that we see certain features to exist in certain layers. For example, if the neurons are receiving inputs directly from the thalamus, then you would expect that those features would encode lower level properties of speech, that you don't need to have a long time span over which to then decide whether or not you're going to fire. And so that might be well suited for encoding things like, for example, that it's this fricative speech property. Whereas for other properties of speech that actually you need to have listened to the speech for a number of time samples to really figure out what that feature is, like the pitch of the voice, for example. Like, in order for me to know that the pitch of your voice just increased, I need to be able to compare the pitch of your voice now to the pitch of your voice like 100 milliseconds ago. And so that would require some type of longer time scale, maybe recurrent process, which, as I just described, might be well suited for something that's happening in layer 3 that has a lot of these recurrent connections. So this is all kind of stipulation that needs to be further tested. But I think that we're going to find that it's not a coincidence that certain features localize to certain depth, but that this naturally emerges from the connectivity structure of the neurons themselves and what inputs they're receiving and how complex those inputs are and over what time scale those inputs operate over.
Right. This is fascinating. So one thing I was thinking about is that I think very early on you were mentioning that how speech is something that you really need to study in human because like language is complex and other animals do not really have that yet. But I'm also wondering, as you said about the different features of the sound, for example, the pitch is very different. That, I think, is something that animals that rely heavily on vocalizations would also basically need to identify and notice. So I guess I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on to what extent the findings you have on the organizations of these neural population is something specific to human speech versus basically if you just get animals that rely on vocalization, you can find it in their response to their co-specific calls.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And there's been a lot of really wonderful work with animal models, some with neuropixel probes, but going back for many years, people have been recording single neurons on a smaller scale, but answering similar types of questions. And you're right, the acoustic features that we're looking at here are also used for animals to communicate, even though we might not call it language per se, it's still a way of using audition to communicate something. And there are similarities in some of the features that are encoded. Some animals have a more similar auditory system to humans than others. So there's been a lot of work with ferrets and gerbils, for example. You can read out from their neural responses and actually, you find a lot of similarity in the types of features, as if they're hearing a bee like barricade or a pea like parakeet. Is that because they like use speech? No, it's because those sounds are different. But where the crucial difference comes in is that the neurons in the human brain are like warp their sensitivity. So they're much more sensitive to the crucial or ambiguous points between two speech sounds, for example, like they have those boundary points. Whereas with an animal that does those boundaries don't mean anything to them, then they will just be a linear readout of the acoustics that they heard rather than like warping the acoustic space to emphasize what's important and de-emphasize what's not important.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I never thought about a speech in that way. I really appreciate how detailed and clear that you have brought me through understanding this paper because it was a really, really dense and kind of intimidating paper for me. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on where this line of work is going.
Yeah, this is such an exciting moment. And this paper is the first paper recording neuropixels in humans to understand speech comprehension. So this really represents the first of what I think is going to be a paradigm shift in the types of questions that we can now address and the precision with which we can answer them. This isn't just like a step forward in improvement. It's really like a lens change. And I think that crucially, what changes is that we're able to look at this computational circuit, so this shell-like structure, to understand how complex properties of speech emerges through the communication between these different layers and come up with theories of how even just with these elemental processing units of single neurons that are a binary code, they either fire or they don't, how these very complex representations and ultimately comprehension of novel and complex ideas, how that emerges. And I think that it's really going to force the theories to be very precise and very specific about how all of this is achieved at the single neuron level, like all the way down to the implementation. Whereas up until this point, I think that the theories have been more at the algorithmic level in kind of David Marr's framework. But by bringing in the implementation, it's going to really force us to be very specific about how this actually operates, not just at what computations are applied, but how that even, how that gets implemented. So I think this is really going to push the forefront of our understanding of in human neuroscience, which I think has been a little bit held back by not having the tools of this precision and granularity.
Yeah, that's so exciting. I feel like the progress in how we understand speech is so fast, and I feel like the world right now is very different from back then when I was learning about this as an undergrad. So I'm very excited to see more of your work coming through. I know we are almost at the end of our time here, but before I let you go, I feel like I really wanted to know about how you have got yourself into this area of research. So how did you become interested in studying speech and brain? And is that something that you always wanted to do?
Yeah, I will give you the short version of what is a much longer conversation. But I studied linguistics in my undergrad degree. Honestly, mainly because I really love writing. And I thought that by doing a linguistics degree, this would give me the tools I needed to get some jobs that required a lot of writing, which it did in the end, but not exactly in the way that I thought. Yeah. Through my undergrad degree in linguistics, I really fell in love with the scientific and like structural approach to understanding language structure. I found it amazing that even though languages on the surface seem very different, if you listen to someone speaking Basque or Arabic or English, they sound like completely different, non-overlapping ways of communication. They seem like totally alien from each other. But if you actually break them down into their structures, so what is the sentence structure being used? How do the pieces come together? What are the rules about how the word order needs to be in order to make sense? Then actually, they're very similar. And I found this to be a kind of beautiful paradox, that something on the surface can look so distinct, but actually if you have the right toolkit to describe it, actually it's very systematic. And yeah, that systematicity got me interested in, okay, then how do the humans actually process speech? So rather than, I started off just in the theoretical sense of getting the toolkit of how to describe language structure. And then I wanted to move to being able to understand how humans use that structure to understand language. So then I did a master's degree actually very specifically focused on that question. So in the cognitive neuroscience of language in the Basque country, they have a research center focused on this question. And then it was there that I really realized that I'd found exactly the field that I wanted to work in. And so I continued to pursue that in my PhD and my postdoc and now in my faculty position at Stanford. And yeah, along the way, I have gathered more tools for my toolkit. So we also, as you can see, I think it's really important to work with different types of neural recording technique. And that's been something that I've built across the years as I've found my interests and research questions. And I also use a lot of machine learning. And I think that it's a very timely moment, honestly, for human neuroscience. and language neuroscience specifically because of these advances in technology like the NeuroPixels probe and also advances in AI with all of these large language models. It gives us a really rich set of, keep using the word tool, but a really rich set of tools to be able to understand this very complicated system in the brain. But I think that maybe we finally have a shot of understanding how this works with all of these tools at our disposal.
Thank you so much. And I would like to thank you again for joining the show today. And I look forward to read more of your work in the future and also run into you in the department at some point.